Granted, for the fourth time this week, the Mets came from behind to a baseball game.
Yeah.
Why is this such a great rally team?
You know, I think we believe in ourselves, and we know that if we just keep pressing on the dam, you know, eventually it'll break. You know, and we just try and put really good at-bats together, and sometimes, hey, I mean, it doesn't work, you know, it's baseball. 3 out of 10 times, you're really stinking good at this game, you know, and so I think we just have a big belief system in that clubhouse that if enough guys put good at-bats together, and we just keep the gas pedal down and we just keep taking our shots, that, you know, eventually in a game over the course of 9 innings, we're going to break through. We have so many good hitters that we believe in ourselves a lot. So also you have games like Atlanta and you have games like Milwaukee, and it makes you believe in yourself even more. You know, why not us? So, you know, just really proud of these guys and just the fight in them and to never give up.
Well, take me inside those at-bats in the eighth inning. Five singles. And you had an 0-2 pitch you took the other way, one of those hits.
Yeah, you know, just you're trying to be short and straight to the ball you know, just try and find the barrel somehow. The infield's in, so, you know, it's not going to take a lot, you know, in order to get the job done. But you're just trying to not do too much there. And, you know, for us, again, it goes back to that mantra of just go up there with a plan, you know, take your shots. It's not going to work out every single time, but if everybody does that, you know, hopefully it'll work out over the long term. And so just trying to do that. Just trying to help my team however I can and just be short and direct to the ball. And, you know, I was able to find the barrel and be able to shoot it through the other way. And then that's just perfect, you know, I think, look at our team is, you know, we didn't hit one home run, just playing good baseball, running the bases well, getting in scoring position. Francisco gets us started with a great at-bat in the walk there, and then Mark being able to get a great hit with two strikes as well to tie up the game. And then, you know, I have Pete hitting a great long fly ball to be able to score. And I just think it was just good, solid baseball and something that, you know, you would even put on a reel of like, hey, here's how you play the game and here's how you win without hitting the home run.
It's fun to watch. One more game on the road, and then you get to go home.
Yeah, I know. It's been 2 weeks. It's been 2 weeks on the road, and we've loved every minute of it. We've been having a lot of fun. But, yeah, that'll be really nice to bring some playoff baseball back to the Mets.
What impresses you the most about the type of at-bats that you work in and the way that you're able to come through there?
Yeah, really good at-bats, especially against some elite arms, you know. Alvarez, get us going. Continue to fight, continue to try to put the ball in play, try not to chase as much. You know, Alvarez get us going, like I said, then Lindor, an unbelievable at bat there, ended up walking, and then Vientos finding a way to put the ball in play. I think it was a slider down in a way that he was able to hook it down the line. And then we just continue to add on, you know. Nemo, tough left-on-left matchup. I think it was with two strike as well, going the other way. And this is something that we've done, you know, throughout the year, when we're clicking as a team offensively, these are some of the things that we do. We put the ball in play, we use the whole field, and we're not thinking too big, you know. And we did it today again. Situational hitting today was really good. A couple of sack flies, and that's not easy to do when you're facing, you know, those type of arms. So credit to our guys. We're gonna continue to do that.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, October the 6th, 2024. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, Talking Mets, no G. And don't forget the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks from the Fan-Sided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another reaction edition, a postseason edition of the Talking Mets podcast. I come to you on this Sunday morning, a day after the Mets defeated the Phillies in Game 1 of the NLDS, 6-2. They go 1-0 up in the series, another game at 4 o'clock today. And away we go. Now, I'll start by saying this. I saw some fans upset about the start time. I have to tell you, I don't mind the 4 o'clock start time on the weekends. Get, you know, these are long games, these are stressful games, so away you go. I'll take the 4 o'clock start time. The 5 o'clock during the week at Citi Field, which is what I saw it to be. I wonder if they'll move that a little bit, depending on how other series go. It's, you know, I don't think there'll be sweeps before them, but that's a little annoying. But anyway, I'll just start with that. What you saw yesterday, before I get into the big picture comment I want to make here, and I think it's a comment that Mets fans know already. I think the rest of the league is learning about it. And the national media, who will probably be the last one to the party, maybe they don't see it yet, but they soon will too. The first things first, what you saw to Zach Wheeler for seven innings. If you're a Mets fan that's, you know, only been watching the Mets for the last 20, 25 years, you're a little bit younger. What you saw is what Mike Scott did to the Mets in 86, or an Orr Hershiser did to the Mets in 88, or maybe when they were playing the Braves in some of those matchups, although they hit the Braves well, you know, some of those elite starters would do to the Mets. But really, it was reminiscent of Scott or Hershiser as I'm watching Wheeler just throw that heavy fastball, 97, 98 miles an hour. Mets, forget the shadows, the Mets just couldn't do anything with it, couldn't make hard contact, couldn't make any contact, all those swings and misses that he had. And as I'm sitting there, I'm saying, well, this is bringing me back to a couple of things. First, those elite postseason performances that I mentioned with Scott and Hershiser, and how hard it was to eke out a win against those guys. I mean, heck, you could even say Nolan Ryan, Bob Knepper, guys, all those guys that the Mets faced back in the 80s. This is what it was like facing those individuals at their peak. And as I'm thinking about that, I'm also thinking about how wrong I was about Wheeler. And I don't want to get deep into that the day after a big Mets win, but how Wheeler, when he gave the Mets a chance to match the contract that right now is expiring at the end of the year with the Phillies before he gets his new extension kicks in, how wrong I was on Wheeler. Wheeler has turned out, in my opinion, and there's still more baseball left to be played, the best out of all those pitchers that were the five aces. I mean, he was the original acquisition. I mean, Harvey was drafted the year before, but Wheeler was one of the first acquisitions in the Beltran trade, and because of some development, stunted development, injuries, things like that, he was the one that took the longest maybe to get to where he needs to be, but he might be the best. And I would argue because of his durability, because of the fact that he could go deep into ball games and go 110 pitches like you saw yesterday in a big spot, he's better than DeGrom, I'll say that. And statistically, when you look at wins above replacement, since he signed with the Phillies, I think he's either the best or the second best pitcher in baseball. So the Mets going into this series are facing the best pitcher in baseball over the last 5 years. Nola, who I think is a little bit overrated, but a really good pitcher, he's right up there statistically. So the Mets have their work cut out for them in three of the five games in this series. And look, I don't know who's pitching game four, whether they come back with, you know, Ranger Suarez. I know that Sanchez is pitching today, Nola game three at Citi Field. So the Mets, similar to that Dodgers series about 10 years ago, which Kershaw and Greinke, have their work cut out for them, for sure. And I was thinking a little bit of that with Wheeler. But when it's all said and done, the start of Senga, I liked it. I think it was funny that it was even somewhat controversial. If McGill is your other option, and I know McGill has come a long way, you just don't know what you're going to get out of McGill, especially against a really good Phillies lineup, one of the best lineups in the league. Little bit top-heavy, but a really good lineup. And at this point, after you saw Maton shaky a little bit, Stanek shaky a little bit, if Senga could come out on his regular turn, even if for the rest of the postseason, he could only give you about 60 pitches, play a pseudo-opener, and then piggyback with a bullpen game, or maybe you line him up with Peterson so Peterson can give you 3 to 4 innings. I think it would behoove the Mets to go that route because those are better innings, I think, that you can cobble up than what you're going to get night in and night out with Maton and Stanek. And we talked a little bit about this with during the Milwaukee series. The Mets have pitchers, and this is where this whole fungible bullpen, and I'm not saying Stanek and Maton are not good arms because they've had success in other places, and they have good stuff, but they're not locked down. They're not somebody that if they come in the game, no matter what part of the order they come through, I'm confident that they're going to get the job done. Diaz, you have other concerns, but for the most part, you know you have a very high chance of Diaz getting through that. Everybody else in this bullpen, Buto, Stanek, Maton, I mean, Reed Garrett has been maybe the best out of all these guys in terms of how he looks. You're not sure what you're going to get. So the fact that they used Senga in that role, I think, was smart. And ultimately, the Mets did what you had to have to do against guys like this. Guys that are pitching like Oral Hershiser, 88, Mike Scott, a Roy Halladay-type performance, a Nolan Ryan-type performance. You got to match them pitch for pitch. You got to wait them out. And the difference in today's ball game versus maybe 40 years ago is that Hershiser wasn't going to come out. Scott wasn't going to come out. They were going to push you. And in 2024 baseball, Wheeler, who is the gold standard of going long, nobody goes 120-plus pitches anymore. But Wheeler will take you to 100-plus, 110. If the Mets didn't push him and work some counts earlier in the ball game when they couldn't hit him, they couldn't touch him in some ways, but when they did, it was weak contact. Maybe he gets the eighth inning. Maybe he's able to go a lot longer. And although Strom and Hoffman and all these guys coming out of the bullpen with the Phillies are not chopped liver, they're actually quite good. But they're still relievers. They're still coming in to a situation that some of them may be a little bit new to. And that is giving the Mets the best possible outcome of winning. So it's a team, and I think this is the real message. It's a team that is growing before our eyes, is peaking before our eyes, very similarly to the 2015 squad, I think, and gaining a lot of confidence. You heard Brandon Nimmo in the post game on the way in. I think it's an organization that is starting to blossom in front of us. I think the things they were doing all year were always present. I don't think that we were watching, so to speak, because we were so hung up on who the Mets have been as an organization, specifically for the last two decades. So I keep talking about how this innocent climb that started with slaying some demons down in Atlanta is so important to the future of the Mets under Cohen ownership. Well, you're starting to see them push forward from the work they did just this week. And ultimately, the national media, who I think because they don't quite get the OMG, the grimace, they have this narrative, amazing and believe about the Met fan. They've all been rehearsed on LOL Mets and, you know, Casey Stengel and the 62 Mets. And I listened to them talk about the Mets during the broadcast. And I'm not even talking about Big Poppy and Jeter and those jokers, because, look, I don't care what Derek Jeter has to say, because I know Derek Jeter hasn't watched a lot of baseball this year. He does his national in-studio work, but I doubt, other than the information he's given, that he's putting any time in on any level watching the game right now. So whatever he says means absolutely nothing. And honestly, it's like Shaq and Barkley and Kenny Smith. They have their biases too. So I'll put those guys aside. But the fact that the national media talks about the Mets and talks about like this grimace, OMG, like this is little engine that could team that snuck into the playoffs, has no business being here, is this significant underdog, is laughable. Because at some point, and look, it doesn't matter. All the Mets have to do is win, and that will take care of itself. But at some point, a team that from June 1st onward played on a pace to win around 100 games. I mean, every month they were over 600 baseball, except for August when they went on those gnarly West Coast trips, and they played 540 baseball. That is a team that is as good, if not better, than anybody left in the postseason. Okay, the Phillies are not significantly better. I don't think the Dodgers are significantly better. I don't think the Padres are significantly better. Now, matchups on and on, you could give each side advantages. But right, and certainly there's a soft underbelly to this Mets team. But everybody has a soft underbelly. And the fact that the Mets are looked at as this little engine that could, this little underdog, fine. You know what? If that's what's going to keep the Mets into the karma bank, into the right sphere to keep this thing going, fine. But everybody is finding out, and I hope you as a Mets fan is finding out, that this is a serious team. The rally that they had in the eighth inning, the way they executed it, the way they worked the counts earlier in the ball game, the way when they had an opportunity to cash in, they didn't do a lot. Nimmo going the other way. J.D. Martinez taking the pitch up the middle to get a base hit. Iglesias extending the rally. What a great at-bat. Later in the ball game, Bader getting the stolen base and then Nimmo adding on. Even though it was a four-run lead in Citizens Bank Park against that lineup, wanting to stay away from Diaz, that was an important run. The defense that they play, how Iglesias made that nice play on Baum in the eighth inning when Maton was starting to bend a little bit. These are things they've been doing all year, and these are the reasons why they're winning. They're not a team that has to sit back and wait for the three-run homer. They want it. They needed it the other night in Milwaukee, but they're a team that keeps on pushing in a different way. When I think of an offensive team that pushes and puts pressure on an opposing team, I think of like those post-2000 Yankees offenses. You know, 07, 08, 09. I mean, it was like every inning there was a guy on base because it was hard to get through clean innings with them. And that puts a lot of pressure on a pitcher. The Mets aren't necessarily that kind of offense because you'll see they'll go seven innings with nothing and then they'll have that five-run inning. And once they get going, like a wind-up toy, you can't stop them. It's like the Energizer Bunny at that point. But in those six or seven innings, like you saw yesterday, they're doing some small things, whether it be working the pitch count of Wheeler or even in their own way, figuring out how they're going to be able to put themselves in good hitting positions later in the ballgame. They're using constant information, constant situations to push themselves, as Nimmo said, to push themselves toward the dam to make it break. They're not losing confidence. They know they have guys that if they get a couple of runners on base, they have guys that could do big things. They're not trying to do big things or play hero ball. And if they can continue to do that, I don't care if they're facing Wheeler, they're facing Nola, they're facing whoever, they have a really good chance of winning. Now, the part that has to come into play to get this done so that the game is within reach is the pitching. And right now, it's the starting pitchers. And that's why the amount of innings you can get from the starters, I think, gives you the best chance of winning night in and night out, because I really believe the real soft underbelly, and yes, the theme of getting the ball to Diaz is going to be the situation throughout the postseason. He's the guy, ultimately, in most games, is going to have to put the final hammer down. But you have 6 to 9 outs, depending on the day, that you have to get. If you could get, at the beginning of the game, from a Senga, 6 to 9 of those outs, great. Even better. You know, if you want to spot a Maton, a Garrett, or a Stanek, great. But I think that's what they're going to have to do, because the formula that we thought that they'd have, where they had Maton, who had a great second half when he came over to the Mets, to Diaz. I mean, Maton right now looks shaky. And I don't know if it's overwork or maybe now that the competition has elevated and they have a chance to really study him and see him night in and night out, that he's getting exposed a little bit. I don't know, but I think right now, and look, Mendoza's a guy that he's done everything well so far. He was going to go to Maton. I remember when they took the 2-1 lead, I said, all right, if this is all they're going to get, let's get Diaz for the top of the order and then figure out the ninth inning, similar to what they did in Milwaukee. He had Maton warming up. He was going to go to Maton against the top of the order, which was interesting. I know there was some points, and we had made the points on the Twitter spaces last night. Is it possible that they wanted to stay away from Diaz again? One of the things that Mendoza had talked about in the various interviews he had after the celebration in Milwaukee was that Diaz wanted to come out again for the bottom of the ninth in Milwaukee in the clinching game. He wouldn't allow him. And he pointed out that over the course of a week between Atlanta, what he did the other night in Milwaukee, and then obviously the Sunday game before even all this craziness started, he had about 100 pitches in a week, which is historically high for a closer. Now, Goose and guys like that back in the day might have something to say about that, but let's face it, Goose and those guys weren't throwing 100 all the time like Diaz. I'm sure Goose was throwing hard, and I don't know if they had the complicated mechanics that Diaz has, nor a pitcher that has been really trained on sprinting is now asked to run a marathon. So there you go. So it was big that they did get, no, the Phillies did get Diaz up, which, does that have an impact? Who knows? I personally think Diaz staying warm and his mechanics staying exercised is important. We'll see what that brings today if the Mets are in a position to lock down the game with Diaz late. But really, the part that I think we all have to wrap our heads around is this, yeah, the grimace, the OMG, the run, the story. Sports is a great avenue to create a soap opera and a story. And when the season's said and done, and even if it is for fodder for these kind of shows that you're listening to right now, a narrative and a story is something that's always going to be woven. And if you want to weave it where the Mets were dead and buried and the little engine that could and heart and character, which are all good things, that's fine. But they're more than that. And I think you're seeing that. You're seeing the growth of an organization. You're seeing players play within themselves and are the best version of themselves because, one, the organization's putting them into a position to be successful, and two, they're just staying within who they are. I mean, they're playing the game to what the game is giving them. And that's how you win a championship. And this is not going to be an easy series. The Phillies are not just going to crawl into a hole and go away. I mean, Harper was already talking about after the game their approach at the plate. It sounded like he was challenging them to be more selective. And if I were the Mets and Severino going into today, I wouldn't get into a habit of not throwing strikes. And I think that's been one of the bigger parts of this postseason. The Mets have been minimizing the walks. They've been throwing more strikes. They've been giving themselves a chance to win. I firmly believe one of the biggest, and I've said it all year, those who've listened, one of the biggest reasons the Mets were held back at times was the excessive amount of walks that the staff was putting up there. I mean, they, by rights, those kind of walks that they put up, they shouldn't be here. But they are. So that's really my message for the morning after marinating on the 6-2 win. The blueprint was there. It was a little bit different because they used an opener strategy. They didn't have to give the ball necessarily to Diaz because they scored enough. They put up their crooked number. And now to game two, and Chris, you know, I guess it's Sanchez that is going to take the ball. Rob Thompson's looking at his home splits. You're asking a young pitcher, and we'll see. He'll have the home ballpark behind him to really pitch the game of his life because if you're the Phillies, anything could happen. And I don't think the Phillies are going to be scared of Citi Field. It's going to be a tough place to play, and we'll see what kind of crowd shows up to Citi Field. I'm sure it'll be raucous. But let's see when the Mets get kicked in the teeth at home, how the crowd reacts. That'll be another story for another day. But you now, if you're the Mets, you've put yourself in a position where the Phillies are the ones that have to answer the bell today. I don't ever like to say games are house money, but because you want to get greedy. You got that first game. And if you have an opportunity to win game two, take it. Put the pedal to the metal here. Because remember, the 2015 Mets had a chance to do that to the Dodgers. That was the Utley game, and they didn't. They had a chance to win that game, really put pressure on LA. And they came home, and they split, but then they had to come back to Citizens Bank Park, well, to LA at that point, to beat Greinke. Seeing how Wheeler has played that Hershiser-Scott role, and I'll use those terms because that's the villains from when I was a kid in the postseason. You probably want nothing to do with that 5 o'clock game on Friday. So whatever you can do to win two out of the next three, whether it be two at Citi Field or really put the pedal to the metal and put the hammer down on the Phillies and sweep them here in the first two games at home, I would make it a point. I don't think it's impossible to win a Wheeler game and a decisive Game 5 in Philadelphia. The Phillies have lost decisive Game 5s going far as back to the Ryan Howard, Jimmy Rollins, Utley days. But I don't think you want to be in that situation. But ultimately, this is not an amazing and believe organization. You want, those are narratives, those are fun, and they've had amazing and believe moments throughout this postseason the last week and a half. But they are an organization that has good veterans, that has good player development guys, that has good coaching, that is doing everything that a lot of the smart organizations have done over many, many years, and they're actually trying to do some of these things better. Give credit where credit's due. We continue to talk about what the Mets don't have and what they aren't. I'll tell you what the Mets are. They're a really tough team. And if you're within a run of them, and I know there's randomness to that, late, and you're the opposition, and the minute they get a guy on, and maybe they push and get another guy on, you're starting to think, oh, here they come. And I hate to do this. I know this bothers a lot of fans, and it's not a fair comparison because this team hasn't won Bupkis yet. but they remind you of how those mid-90s Yankees teams that weren't always filled like the post-2000 versions with the best of the best at every position, just as soon as that team got going, as soon as that team got into positions where they can make a big play or get a big hit, they did. And you always felt that doom was around the corner because they just kept coming at you. Even when they didn't look good and they didn't hit and they had guys that were more declining towards the end of the run with guys like Martinez and Brocious who had good moments but were starting to show their warts and their age, those guys still were able to get big moments when they were needed. So on to game two this afternoon at 4 o'clock, an early start. Excited about it. And I'll leave you with one other thing. We keep talking about Lindor as an MVP because of his numbers, but not just because of the play he made in Milwaukee the other day to end the ball game. We talked about that. But again, in the middle of a rally, just like in the ninth inning in Milwaukee, Lindor not trying to do too much, taking the walk with two strikes. I really think the more that and I know Ohtani hit a home run yesterday in the postseason, and the Dodgers came back and won. And I'm not saying they're going to vote for Lindor over Ohtani, but the gap between the decision of MVP, if anybody who has to vote is watching any of these postseason games, honestly, and watching Lindor, how can you not seriously consider him for the MVP? It's amazing to me. So I'll leave you with that. All right, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this reaction edition to Game 1 of the NLDS Mets-Phillies. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G. Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG. Check out the newsletter, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting the show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the game today. I'll be on the Twitter spaces with our good friend Anthony Rivera, Subway to Shea, after the ball game. See you then. Till then, enjoy your afternoon, everybody.